Hello, my name is Matthew Kidman, and welcome to the latest episode of Success and More Interesting Stuff, brought to you by Livewire Markets. Richard White always wanted to be a rock star. He was still young when it dawned upon him it might be more profitable and more realistic to become a tech titan. Sounds simple enough, but the journey has taken many twists and turns over 40-odd years. White thought life was perfect, hanging out in a rock band and rubbing shoulders with the likes of AC/DC and the Angels. Unfortunately, he was going broke. A problem solver, he pivoted and thought repairing guitars for established rock stars was a way to make an interesting living. The business was a resounding success, but it wasn't perfect. It couldn't be scaled, and another salient lesson was learnt. A lighting business was built and sold, and then a stint in the computer distribution game rounded out some much-needed business skills. In between ventures, White took on some consultancy work. Just by chance, some of his clients were in the freight forwarding game, and White, ever alert, identified things could be done a lot better. So he got to work again and started writing software, even though he had little practical training. He had twigged the entire freight forwarding industry needed a hand, and he took his products and started selling it more broadly. It is rare that one individual can write the software and then sell it. That was way back in the late 1980s. During the 1990s, his business became the platform for many major transport companies. Not satisfied, White decided to disrupt his own business. In the early 2000s, he rebuilt his product suite before forging into North America and Europe. With a name change to WiseTech, the company followed its customers and spread its tentacles around the globe. In 2016, White decided to list on the ASX. He thought publicly traded shares would give him the currency he needed to buy the missing bits to cement a global empire. He was right. Close to 50 acquisitions later, WiseTech owns the space. The share price has risen a staggering 26 times from $3.35 to $90. Today, WiseTech is valued at $30 billion and is the largest software company listed on the ASX. According to White, the music is still playing and WiseTech has a few hit songs to knock out yet. Welcome, Richard.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Yeah, that was the hardest introduction I've had in 30-odd shows because you covered a lot of ground. So it was tough to get through it all, but we got there. Thanks for coming in. So let's get to the serious bit. You're an old rocker, and I like my music as well. I was going to ask you favourite song, favourite band, and favourite album.
Here's a problem.
That's hard work.
Yes, I find the idea of a favourite something quite an annoying concept because I like a lot of variety and I change my mind about things quite often. I like different things. I would listen to, there's fabulous guitarists in the world, there are fabulous songs in the world, but I've got, I'm actually jazz trained and so I can play, you know, Latin jazz or jazz or rock or blues, and I like music and I like great players and I like great bands. You know, there are iconic bands. But if I name one, I feel like I'm letting other people down.
No, you're not cheating on anyone. At least give us a band.
I liked Carlos Santana. Mm-hmm. I was an aficionado in the early days of Richie Blackmore because of his technique. David Gilmour from Pink Floyd. And Pink Floyd generally, I think, is an amazing band. It's kind of a jazz fusion blues rock band, really.
And a lot of technology in there.
A lot of technology, a lot of very interesting ideas in amongst it all. Amazing live productions as well. Sting is fantastic. You know, so I have this palette. I really even like Astrid Gilberto, which is in Latin jazz, and a lot of those guys. That's a fantastic...
Wide variety. Tell me, here's something for you. I noticed in previous discussions you've always prided yourself on disrupting something and moving forward. Something can be done better. How have you gone with your music? You like a wide variety. Do you like modern music as we all get a bit older?
I like music that has melody, that has meaning, that has a lyrical sense to it, that has a structure that has a beauty about it. A lot of music, both in the 70s, 80s, 90s, all the way through to today, there's music that we'll like for an instant and forget about forever. But there are some things that you live with forever. I mean, I can't think of anything right off the top of my head, but you know it when you remember it always. And there are things that have lingered from the 90s for me, and there are things that I, because of Latin jazz, that's the 40s, 50s, and 60s.
Still with you.
Still with us. And I think, you know, you just have to understand that it's the beauty of the art that I like. And as far as problem solving, the reason I started repairing guitars is because I tricked up my guitars amazingly. The action was fantastic. The machine heads were great. The way the guitar worked, the frets, the way that you could bend the strings, the way that electronics worked. And people just used to ask me, how do you do that stuff? And I'd say, well, I've just done, you know. And my father was an engineer, and I had this fusion of engineering and guitar skills. So it became a business of repairing guitars. Sounds pretty mundane, but I was actually really making guitars into really really good instruments.
Must have been good fun in those days when you... Well, you could have been a rock star, but as you said, as we said in the introduction...
A starving rock star.
Starving. It was a very hard way to make a living.
I talk about myself as being an economic refugee from the music industry, because I worked in the music industry even past that. The lighting business was also an entertainment lighting business, and then I was the R&D manager at Jans Electronics, which was great, and is still a great Australian company that does entertainment, audio, and lighting. So... You know, that's a vein of my career that's very interesting. And my father was a refrigeration engineer, so I have this weird understanding of refrigeration. So when we build our data centers, I did all the refrigeration calculations and designs for the spreader boxes and for all of the stuff that you do in the cold aisle containment. So that's just I'm a collector of knowledge. I'd like to learn things and keep them.
And you're a doer. I find that very interesting. That bit that you're talking about there. You talk about your father's an engineer. Mm. I've heard that your grandparents, had their own catering business.
It was a function centre.
Yeah. So an eclectic mix, but you're exposed to different parts of the economy and small businesses. Do you want to elaborate a little bit how that influenced you and maybe equipped you to go forward? Because you became a serial entrepreneur.
And there are four people... my mother and my father, my grandfather and my grandmother, and they all had different skills. And I never wanted to work in their businesses long term, but I wanted to learn everything that they knew. And they were all entrepreneurs.
When did you know you had to learn from them?
I didn't really think of it as learning. I was just curious. It wasn't. I didn't think. I went to school to learn, and I did other things that were much more interesting than when I was at home and when I was working. Like I was working in the function centre. There was wedding receptions mainly, from the age of 12. And my job at the age of 12 was to run this huge dishwashing machine. And you know, I was a tall kid, but still 12 years old. And there's this massive handle on the dishwashing machine, and I felt this immense sense of elation because I was doing something and I was being paid. Now, receiving that little brown envelope every week with cash in it was just an amazing feeling. And I'm sure my grandfather deliberately made a ceremony of giving me that little pay packet.
As a lesson to see?
As a connection between effort and reward. Mm-hmm. At 12 years old, that's a powerful lesson. I don't remember what I did with the money. And I don't even remember how much money it was, but I remember vividly
receiving that package,
me being paid, and thinking this immense sense of achievement because I'd done something. My mother was a very good salesman and ran a number of businesses, and I observed what she did and how she promoted things and how she talked and how she acted.
So what business was she in?
She sold. She did these home like Avon, but for various products, and some people would have it at our home, and I'd watch when she was proffering the products to the people, and she'd invite them, we'd put on food. It was just a whole elaborate thing. She also worked for my father in his refrigeration business.
He owned his own business,
he did. It was right. John White Refrigeration. Mm-hmm. And I worked in his factory. His factory was 300 metres from the door of my high school. So I'd walk out of Sydney Tech High, which Sydney Technical High School's in Hurstville. Mm-hmm. I literally walked to my father's factory. Now, he would go home for dinner, but I'd be out there at 3:15. And I would work in the factory. He'd teach me a weld and do electrical things and teach me the concepts involved in compressors and the physics of refrigeration and so forth. And he was very knowledgeable and actually had a deep skill set in mechanical things.
Like was he a good salesman or not?
No, terrible salesman.
So he was more technical.
Yeah, he was very good at building things and repairing things and making things. And he had all the tools. He had lots of machinery and he had lots of things. And he could give me a process. I became an extremely good welder at my father's factory. I'm a really good welder. I mean, that's not a skill that you lose.
You normally do an apprenticeship, and it's quite dangerous. But you were doing it on your own.
Well, he taught me. I think the fact is I was watching people do things and I was just curious to learn. I was at school pretty disinterested in most of school except for maths and science, which I really liked. Everything else was kind of, I don't know why I'm doing this. You know, I didn't understand why commerce was a thing or why geography was a thing, but I really liked maths and science. And my grandfather was the entrepreneur of the family. He had a very sophisticated way of understanding business, and he had a good reputation in the local area. And my grandmother was kind of like an operations manager, and she would have all the staff, you know, running the whole place with 50, 60 staff, and she would just be completely in control of everything and knowing what to do. And that was, these were just observed behaviours that I thought, that's a thing that you can learn.
Terrific training ground. Mm. And I think I've heard you say before, genetics is interesting, but it's hard to see what's attributed to everyone. But they seem like a good skill mix that's held you in good stead going forward.
I think it's more nurture than nature, to be fair. I mean, like, genetics must play some part, but the experience that you have and the ability to hone your skills and to do things repetitively so that you become very fluent at something is actually the core skill. People want to have people around that are fluent in something.
And you've done a lot of businesses in your time. If we take that skill base that you had, and you've done a lot, and as I said before, serial entrepreneur, what is the thrill? And did you feel that from a young age? Is it the thrill of coming up with an idea, a solution, putting it into place, seeing it work through? Or is it something more than that?
Look, ideas are pretty common. Getting an idea to work, that's pretty hard work.
That's the hard bit.
I really think that the ability to ideate, while that's a very important skill, what you've actually got to do is to put it into practice, which the difference between an idea and a product is truly massive. There's so many twists and turns between making an idea into something that can actually be used. When you think about, just imagine software. So first of all, you've got all these technical underpinnings that you've got to deal with. You've got architecture, you've got a database, you've got a user interface. These are all skills that become quite fluent. I actually learned most of my software skills building lighting equipment because I was programming.
On the job?
In JANS when I was the R&D manager. I actually built a very sophisticated, very early stage lighting controller called the Aurora.
And so just for the listeners, you started your own lighting business, which mainly supplied the entertainment industry.
Correct.
And then eventually sold it, as we said in the introduction.
I merged it into JANS.
Right, and you stayed on and worked there.
I became the R&D manager at JANS, and quite soon after I joined, the computer industry was starting to kick off, and there were very small microcomputers.
So this would be the early 80s, late
70s? Yeah, late 70s. I started playing with computers in the late 70s, and by 82 in JANS, I was programming a chip called a Z80, which was a very famous chip in its day. And that had a massive 64K of RAM and a massive 16K of ROM, and that was it. And I had to make that computer, that chip, run an entire lighting system, 48 channels, you know, controlling all the stage and all the lighting and doing various scenes and recalling and things and so forth and programming things. And that was an enormously hard thing to do, and it took me probably a year of work to build the circuit boards, to design all the circuits, to learn the programming languages and then program it. And I didn't think it was hard at the time. I just thought it was a job that you had to keep going at until you got it done.
But it's very foreign at that stage because, you said, computers were just coming in. Mm. Chips weren't something that we talked about as we do today as driving machines.
Correct.
You must have had an affinity for this way forward, this technology.
I think I've had to think about this because this is an observation. You've had to go back and look at myself and think, how did that happen? One of the things that I have as a skill is I can pretty easily absorb some new idea and then practice it, make mistakes, and then hone it pretty quickly and become relatively fluent in it. For instance, for that time I read four books. I read the CMOS cookbook, the TTL cookbook, the op-amp cookbook, and the triple five timer cookbook, which are all famous books, right? They're the basic circuitry of all of computing. And they seemed just really logical to me, and they stuck. I can still remember, you know, what was on page 62 of the CMOS cookbook because it was vivid, because it was something really interesting to me. If someone rings me and says, can you get milk on the way home, I would forget it. But I can remember those books, like, vividly, like, eidetically.
So well, that suited your way of thinking.
Yes.
And so you use that to your advantage. So you picked up on that very quickly, obviously, because it was a new frontier, computing.
Yes,
but you used it into your lighting business, and you actually transformed the way light was used.
Correct.
In shows. So you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Well, it was probably the first or one of the first computer-controlled lighting systems in the world. And I didn't really have an idea about how it would be. I had to create the concept, along with many of the my co-workers at Jans. We had an idea, and we built it, and it eventually worked. And that Jans actually took that product, and they were many generations on. And I sort of reconnected with the guys in Jans after I left in 85 and started a computer wholesale company, because I was really in love with computers at that stage, and computer networking was a big thing. And in 2015, I reconnected with them, and they were still selling that same product, but many generations on. In 2015, it was a major product of their business.
So a computing distribution business that you set up.
Yes, it was called Clear.
Clear. Very interesting in the sense that you had to sell a product.
Yes.
More so this time than you had in the past, where you were coming up with solutions. So we go to that other side of the skill base. What kind of salesman are you, and was that easy? Did that come naturally for you at the time?
Look, I don't think I'm a heavy salesperson. I'm not trying in there for the clothes. I'm there because I believe in the product and I want the product to be, you know, usable for somebody else. I want to make a point about these businesses, because my first business, being a rock and roll musician, was economically quite challenging, as I said. The second business was very profitable, the guitar repair business. The problem with the business was I couldn't scale it, because it was a very particular personal skill. Can't scale that. The third business, which was the lighting business, was very scalable, but it had enormous capital constraints. And the reason I merged it with Jans is because the business, I moved four times to get bigger and bigger factories, and you have bigger factories, so bigger rent, more equipment, more staff, and more raw materials to build a product. Then you had pay your creditors, run your debtor book, collect money. You know, it became quite a challenging thing. And there's, you know, those businesses have cash flow problems pretty easily.
You learn about cash flow pretty quickly.
Yeah, very. In fact, the good thing about that, and right through till the probably a few years before we IPO'd, I used to run every business on a cash flow statement, not on a P&L. I mean, it doesn't matter if you're making a profit if you can't pay the wages. So cash flows, cash is king.
Cash is king.
But even the business that I started after I left Jans, called Clear Group, it had very big associates with Unisys Computing at the time. So it was lots of PCs, Philips monitors, and many other.
And you went to these manufacturers and said, "I can sell or distribute your product."
I typically did the supplier side business, and I had two other partners that ran the other half. Marie and I were in that business. Marie, my co-founder, and I were in that Clear Group business, and Tanya and Steve Stewart were the other side of the business, and they would deal with the sales. They were very strong on the sales side, but I was good on the supplier relationships and convincing suppliers that we were the right distributor for those businesses.
And did the light go on there that the world was changing and computers was at the forefront of it?
Definitely.
Because you like change, you've established that.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I like to be at the forefront of things and solving problems. That business had the same capital constraints, though. It got very big very quickly, and we were selling, within a year, we were $1 million a month. And from, you know, very little capital, really. I had a bit of seed capital from Jans and a few other things, but comparatively not. And I decided that I would prefer to be in a business that wasn't a hardware business, because you're buying and you're selling, and there's the margin between. And even today, those businesses that sell hardware have tiny margins. But then I became a consultant. I sold my share in the business, and I became a consultant, and I accidentally fell over a couple of freight forwarding customers.
But it seems like that journey up until you got to this consultancy business, which we'll talk about in a second, is that you're driving your car around and you keep turning into corners that look like they're good roads, but in the end they're a cul-de-sac because there's something wrong with the business. And so you have to turn around and go again. Were you ever disheartened, or did you just think, no, I'm learning here, I've got to do something else, I'm on a journey?
And the businesses weren't bad businesses, but I think my early stage, I didn't value the persistence to keep going. In fact, when I founded WiseTech, I remember making myself a very, very distinct promise. This is it. I've got something that I want to run here, and I'm going to do it. This is the last one. I'm not going to change again. So that was a big deal, because the consulting business, I did lots of different things for lots of different people. And I actually, you know, did that a few times between these businesses. I did some consulting work before Clear Group, and I did some consulting work after Clear Group. But what I realized is that in order for you to do something, persistence and consistency over time pays an enormous dividend, because you can then build your product, you can build your client base, you can build your skill set. Your fluency in that business becomes manifestly better than it could be in any business that you've owned for a short time.
And which was the favoured business? Being a rock star or in a band? Being a guitar engineer? Being a lighting engineer? Which did you, if you look back now, which is the fondest memory?
I said about not liking one favourite over another.
It's the same, isn't it? They're all the favourite children.
I think they all had a really deep and meaningful experience to me. And I still have guitars that I built when I was a guitar repairer. I still have really fond memories of creating lighting systems. Ray Hawkins, who was the lighting designer for the Angels, and I virtually accidentally built an entirely new type of light.
You named it after him, I think.
The Ray Light. Yes. Indeed, that's correct. And that was it was a bad accident that turned into a good outcome.
That's a lesson in itself.
Absolutely. You've got to know what to do in hardship, right? And we were right up against the tour dates too, so I didn't have a choice. Necessity is the mother of invention.
Definitely. So you take up the consultancy business, and famously a few of your clients, more than one I think, are in the freight forwarding game.
Correct.
And you identify the freight forwarding game is not as efficient as it should be.
Yes.
So do you remember those clients and what was wrong and what you identified?
Well, there was a few clients, but the one that sticks out, there was two that stick out for me. A company called Container in General, who was run by a Gerhardt and Don. Gerhardt Rasmanner and Don Crichton. And Don Crichton was an extremely intelligent, very sophisticated freight forwarder, and he would quite willingly answer questions about the industry, and he'd have a very sophisticated technical view. And I remember for many years, and I'm still friends with Don, for many years I would ask him complicated questions. He would spend the time to explain and sort of disassemble things and put it back in the right way and teach me the artifacts of the industry. I also had Peter Bruckner, who's Austrian, but the Europeans are very strong in the freight forwarding industry globally. And he ran a company called Powerhouse, and we did a lot of work with Peter, and he actually helped set up the first parts of WiseTech, just helped me with the structure. So these people I was building software for them, but they were also helping me with my understanding of the business. So it's a two-way street.
So two questions there. How did you know how to build software?
Well, I taught myself a chance.
It was self-taught?
Yes. I read those cookbooks, which are hardware books, and then I read a book called Programming in C, which was written by the guy that created C. And then I read a bunch of other programming books, and I just absorbed them and started doing it. I'd never had any fear of failure. I was always, failure is just a step to the success. So if you make a mistake, you just have to fix it.
And what did you identify was wrong with these businesses, and what could be done better?
Well, the businesses that I saw originally, this was in the sort of 1991, all had a set of small systems that didn't talk to each other, that did different things, and there was a lot of paper shuffling. Sometimes you call it sneaker net. You move the paper around the office and people type it in again. And I thought, this industry, we're at a point now where you had enough computing power and enough database power that it should be able to build a system that can make all that one. So I basically took all those fragmented components and built it into one system. I had a friend in New Zealand that already had a start on this. His name was Paul Hawkins. And we together sort of collaborated on some things, and that created the first product. I wrote most of the Australian version of that product. And then I hired my now CTO, Brett Shearer, in 93.
Some years later.
That is true. So in 91, I did a big job in the US on a fulfillment system, which taught me a lot more about the industry and about the software. This is just practice, right? You do more and more of the same stuff and you get fluent at it. fluency features in my thinking a lot of the time. I'm interested in how you become so good at it, you don't think about it anymore, you just do it. Mm-hmm. And by 93, we had a working product. I did a lot of sales in 93. I would go out and I'd pitch to customers and I'd take their orders. I made it very simple to buy the product, very easy, very low cost.
So you've mentioned a few names there that were helping you. Your friend in New Zealand, you hired your first person. But for a long time, lonely journey. You're doing a lot of it yourself. I know four clients, but you're basically relying on your own skill base and your own energy.
True.
That never worried you?
No, I didn't think of it like that. I thought of it as that there were steps along the way. We're always cash positive. I mean, one of the interesting things about WiseTech, we've created the company and we had the first opening ceremony for the company in October 1994. And from then on till today, we never lost money. And I'm talking on a cash basis. We were always cash profitable for the whole of the 30 years we've been in business. And that's a lesson because I'd learned that many years before in the manufacturing business that cash is king. And so you run your business on a cash flow statement. You don't run on a P&L. P&Ls can be very helpful, but they're not what's going to keep your business running. Cash is going to keep your business running.
And you mentioned just there you started to sell. So we're in the 90s now.
Look, I was always a salesman because in the guitar shop, I used to run it at the back of my home. Okay, and people would come to my home and they would give them guitars. And a gentleman that ran a very famous guitar shop called Guitar City, it was near the Hilton, he said, look, if I give you a shop in the building, will you put your business next to mine and I'll refer people to you? Now, this was the most populated shop. People would come. Carlos Santana would wander in every now and then, which was great because I loved his playing. And so I moved into town and people would just walk in the door. I had to think about how do you make someone who's a walk-in a conversion to a customer. So I'd put in really nice flooring, linoleum flooring, beautiful desks, pegboards, all the tools were laid out with shadows. There was velvet on the desks. There were racks for the guitars. The place was scrupulously clean. I had a very smart receptionist that had job cards that was like perfection. And the sale there was not pitching to someone. It was showing people how quality can be built into a business. And the sale was much more marketing than sales. But there is a sort of a selling structure in those things because you've got to be able to provide the customer with confidence that they're going to give them something of value.
So you're often running with the original version of WiseTech. I don't think it was called WiseTech in those days. CargoWise maybe?
Back in the beginning, electronic data interchange was the big thing. And so I thought of Eagle Datamation International.
So mouthful. EDI.
It was, but it was just EDI. And everybody thought that was a cool name. But it became difficult because EDI, the electronic data interchange, and Eagle Datamation became sort of mishmash. So we changed it. When we moved into the US, we changed it. We actually used the name of the company we bought in the US.
So just on that, though, a lot of software companies are run by engineers around the world, and they don't really put enough emphasis into sales. And I suspect engineers generally don't appreciate salespeople. They're different creatures. You're doing both, so you must appreciate both sides of the ledger very well.
I do. I'm not sure I appreciate all types of sales techniques. you know, there's that great joke, what's the difference between a car salesperson and a computer salesperson, a software salesperson?
What is it?
A car salesman knows when they're lying. The problem with software, unless you have very strict controls, in order to get the sale, people can make promises that you can't deliver. So we've got a very controlled and very, very specific, well-marketed sales process. It's much more marketing than sales. The sales is relationship building, really.
And in those days in the 90s, when you took your product out and started to sell it more broadly, did you enjoy that? And was it a door-knocking kind of exercise? Because that was pre-internet.
It wasn't pre. It was just starting to happen. We had email, which wasn't the sort of email you have today. We had email in 91, which was well before the internet.
And you were using that?
Yes, absolutely. Particularly internally, we had a great little internal email system. And our first product had email. This is before, high-value email clients. I had email built into the product itself. These days you wouldn't do that. You'd have the email systems alongside and integrated with it, but not inside the product. But the point was we were very deep into the internet revolution when it came. We had file transfer, file transfer protocol. The system would automatically upgrade over the internet. You could send emails to and from us for support. We would get whenever there was an exception or a problem on the software, it would tell us electronically. So we had a lot of advantages, and many of those ideas from the early 90s became major pieces of the software today.
And you established yourself really well in the domestic market, the ANZ market. But there was a point as we went into the new century where you did a course, got your master's, and decided I need to rebuild my plan if I'm going to go global. So that was a big upheaval in the business.
Well, by 98, I figured out we're going to run out of market. And we were basically Australia, and we had a reasonable chance of getting into New Zealand because very close, same language and very similar systems. But I needed to look at how a worldwide system would work. And so from about 98 to 2002, I spent quite a lot of time on a schema for the world for logistics. So very broad, very deep and broad understanding of the whole world in logistics. And then in 2000, I almost accidentally signed up to a master's degree. I wanted to do one subject. It was a marketing subject. And the lecturer of that subject was someone that I really thought he was a critical thinker and really understood from an engineering perspective what marketing was really about. But I couldn't do his subject first because it was full and I had to do other subjects. And so suddenly I realized this was quite a lot of fun and I could actually use it to grow the business. So I spent the next 2 years in that master's degree, part-time, of course, running WiseTech during the day and doing night and sort of weekends, writing assignments which were effectively business plans. So by the end of 2002, I had a very substantial set of documents that described what the business would look like and how it would grow.
And you took that, you got a decent mark for your academic work, but you took that and took it back into your business.
And every time I finished the subject in that master's degree and I'd come back after having got the assignments marked, my staff would have this look of fear in their eyes because there was a new subject and it's like something's going to change now. But it was a lot of fun, and I actually made it. I made the study very much about the business, and I made the assignments about the business plans.
And so you rebuilt a lot of your products and you took it globally, as we said in the introduction. Were you confident about going global, and why did you know it would work? Because different cultures, different areas, different competitors. There must have been a level of, we can do this.
Yes, but it's constructed like this. So we did Australia. We had a decent-sized business in Australia. And in 2002, we began writing what was the second-generation product. It was called EDI Enterprise, because it was still called EDI at that stage. And we were able to convert our Australian customers. Now, the first thing that happened was Australian customers looked at the product and went, this is crazy. We don't understand this because it's completely different and new. And it's going to... I just want another report in your existing product. I don't want this new product. But we got a few customers live and the productivity results were incredibly good. And so it took over in Australia. We were already in New Zealand and quite established in New Zealand. And we're also established in Singapore, and we took it to those three markets. And that gave me enough confidence because we had international transactions running on the system now, which the previous software would only work in one country at a time.
Right, so the companies that you were dealing with, you were then being able to accommodate them for their international work as well.
Correct, and that was critical because the old model in the industry was this very localized agency model where people would partner with each other, but there was no overarching control system. In coming through this period where China entered the WTO in 1997 and the world became much more global and global trade became much more fundamental, the company started to grow by acquiring all of their local subsidiaries and making them one system. And our product perfectly matched that change in economies. We took out a lot of the costs, those agency models became more irrelevant, and the whole of the system became much more productive than anything you could do on those local bases.
And at all times, you were still profitable, as you said.
Correct.
So that takes me forward. Eventually, you build a very big global business, profitable, and then you take on the two institutional investors and decide to float on the ASX. Well, what was driving that, and why would you take those investors on beforehand?
Well, there were two private high net worth investors that came in 2005 because
earlier
we got the three countries done, and I really thought I'm not going to be able to globalise the business without some capital behind this because the cost of globalising is very large and you have a great extension to your existing business and it's costly. So we raised, I think, about $4.5 million, which seemed like an enormous amount of money at the
time. Do you remember what the price was?
My staff reminded me that in 2005 they got options at 5 cents.
5 cents.
Compared with $90
today.
Nice. It's not a bad rate of return. And Charles and Mike were the two investors. And then we took on two institutional investors in 2015.
Just that first lot of money. Did you actually need that capital? Did you work your way through it to establish the business?
Well, part of that money was used to buy a beachhead in the US. So we've always acquired a small number of companies. We acquired most of our Australian competitors through the 90s. There's only really two left at the end of that. And we acquired a New Zealand competitor, actually the one business run by Paul Hawkins, in 2000.
This is in New Zealand?
My friend in New Zealand, yeah. We bought his business and opened up in New Zealand with our product. And then we bought in 2006, we bought a business in Chicago, which owned the name CargoWise. And so we changed the name of the company to CargoWise EDI. And the press release was written, it didn't really describe who bought who. It was, we're just leaving it up for the people to make their own decision, because I don't think Americans, or for that matter Europeans, would think that an Australian company would be a world leader in logistics software at the time.
But it's a good name, CargoWise.
It is a great name.
Very descriptive.
Chris Ahrens, who was the founder of that business, was at a golf game and he said, oh, CargoWise, you know, he was talking about something to do with cargo. CargoWise, we should do this. And then they sort of said, oh, that's a great name. Let's use it. That's literally how it came about.
Very good. So did those two investors, did they stay with you?
They are still there today.
Their holdings must be worth a lot of money.
I think, yes, I can't tell you what the amount is, but it's substantial. I mean, Charles Gibbs is still on the board and owns about something like, and it's public record, about 5.2% of the stock.
Incredible. Amazing wealth creation for those people. Hmm. I wish I was around at that stage and I knew you. That would have been good. So you built out the business. You rebuilt the products and developing them. You've got a massive footprint. But at this stage, you are very profitable. And you didn't really need to go onto the list to a public market. Is that a fair comment, or is that selling the ambition short and it was a vital step along the way?
I had no pressure at all from my two other investors, Charles and Mike, but we all thought, what is the end game? If you have multiple investors in a company, it's not like a family business anymore. It's something that it's a for-profit business and it's got shareholders. And remember that I gave options to staff in 2005. It was only, maybe only 5% of the company, but it was still a substantial thing to think about. And you owe people a liquidity mechanism and a valuation mechanism. And ultimately, the value of a company that's on a listed market, because it's a liquid investment, it has liquidity and it has a valuation mechanism, is much more valuable than a private company that doesn't have those mechanisms. And So it was inevitable that we wanted to list. There are three things that you get from a listing. First of all, you get the ability, you get liquidity and valuation, which is a critical thing. You get the trust of a public market. You're audited, you have much higher level of sophistication in the way you run a company as a public market. And you get the brand awareness that gives you, the trust that gives you for your customers to trust you because you are a serious, scalable business. Of course, I hadn't done a listing before, so it was a bit of fun as well. I would say fun in the more abstract version of the word fun, because
interesting,
it's pretty,
maybe.
Pretty interesting, yeah. tough but interesting, yeah.
But you took on those two institutional investors in the lead up to the IPO.
Correct.
And my understanding is there was a guaranteed return for them. Is that exaggerating it, or?
No, that was a guarantee. It was a pre-IPO investment that had a return guarantee.
And why would you enter into that? What was the requirement for capital up front?
We were going to start to really push out the growth of the business. And so we bought a business in China, and we bought a business in two businesses in South Africa. Now, we'd bought other businesses with the money that we raised in in 2005 from Charles and Mike, and we've obviously grown and we're profitable. Some of that money that we made was used to create the third generation product in 2014, which was really what got us going. And I had a great deal of confidence in the growth rate of the company. So the return guarantee wasn't that much of a problem because we did make it. We were just a few cents under the return guarantee, so it was really not very costly at all. And as well as that, 3 months before, 4 months before the IPO, we signed DHL, which is, depending how you measure it, the number one freight forwarder in the world, along with Kuehne+Nagel. And we have both those as customers.
How long did it take to win that contract?
It was very fast because they'd had a major failure in 2015. They'd built a platform, it blew up really badly, and they needed something else because their old platform was so old it was going to be a problem. Now, we were under embargo. We couldn't tell the market. We couldn't tell at that time because we weren't listed. And they had to tell their shareholders what was going on. And I remember one of the analysts, the analyst for Credit Suisse, wrote in his analysis of the great company, but they'll never win the world's biggest because they refuse to customise the software. And I had the contract in my hands, but I couldn't tell him it was wrong. I did remind him later on that it was wrong. But that's a great feeling because there are little confidences that you can rely on. You build these things in small steps. It's not like a big leap. It's always just building upon something else and a step at a time, never getting ahead of yourself, never feeling too confident, but always thinking about the risks and how to mitigate them.
We'll get on to risk in a minute, but I just want to stick with the share market listing.
Sure.
It's been a tremendous success. As we said in the introductions, as best as I can work out, 26 times since 2016, which is fantastic. But in between, it's been volatile. And
it continues to be.
Just about every major announcement, whether it be a profit half yearly or an update, there's a big movement. And you're a big company now. Does that worry you? Do you sweat on the share price movements? Because investors do, and no doubt you get a lot of incoming calls when there's a movement or something's changed.
Yeah, I think
it's an added stress.
People, I don't feel that stress particularly. I do understand the volatility, and I'm very respectful of the fact that we have to do our very best to properly inform the market immediately when there's any information that we need to give them. But the only time I really felt stress, we had a short attack in 2019 that was relatively stressful because it's just unexpected.
From a hedge fund?
No, it was what they call a short and distort out of the US. They just produce this report full of completely fabricated ideas and suggest that you're all criminals and that everything's a con and there's no money, no share, no software, no money, no customers, no product, which is nonsense. But, you know, the point is that
it gets aired in public.
It gets aired in public.
And people notice it.
And they don't have a financial services license and they're not entitled to do it in Australia, but they just leak it in through the social media, so it becomes a thing. It was much more the fact that I wasn't worried about the company and I wasn't worried about the statements. I was worried about the impact it had on small shareholders because they get frightened and they sell their shares, and that's where the hedge funds and the short sellers actually make their money. They make their money out of someone selling and them being able to buy that cheaply and then returning the shares back to the lender. Unfortunately, that means that people that get scared lose money. And I didn't sell any money, sell any shares, and my major shareholders didn't sell any shares. We all knew it was a fabrication. And then rolling forward a bit, the other event that I thought was quite stressful, it created a lot of volatility, by the way, was we saw out of China at the beginning of COVID, we saw a dramatic fall in the exports of containers, which it was down on the day that we announced to the market our guidance for the half year in 2020. Container volumes out of China went down 90%.
On that day? Or that week?
Leading up to that, because it takes time to figure those calculations out. We didn't actually have a live system at that. So we now have live reporting of those volumes. But back then, we had to build a data cube and work it out. And I literally, the night before, we rewrote the whole deck and rewrote the whole playbook because we had a completely different model. We knew COVID was incredibly serious. At that time, American shareholders said, you're lying, COVID's not a big thing, what are you talking about? But we knew for a fact that it was a big thing.
It was happening in real time.
Absolutely. And we were the first company in Australia, public company in Australia, to make any substantial negative comment about COVID, but it was the truth.
And that was frightening stuff because none of us knew how that would end up. But it
turned out very well because what happened is people locked out at home. They've got nothing else to do but buy stuff. Right? They buy painting, they buy exercise equipment, they buy musical instruments, and
good
stuff
went through everywhere. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the other side of it, and a couple of subjects that come out of being listed, is that you've made a lot of acquisitions and you've had the currency to do it because you've traded on a decent multiple since you've listed.
And we're very cash positive as well.
Yeah, and 50-odd acquisitions, or somewhere around that mark.
49, say.
49, we'll go with that. Are you a good negotiator? Do you get involved in all of the transactions personally?
I have a very, very high-quality chief execution officer. That's a great name, isn't it?
French Revolution.
Vlad, he's Ukrainian. And he's extraordinary. He's done a number of things across the company. He's had six different jobs, but he does all the M&A. I did all the original M&A, and I spent a lot of time with the buyers, but he does that work now, and I'm a good delegator. That's what happens here. The whole process of growing a company means you have to continue to delegate what you did so that you don't do it anymore and you can raise up more strategically.
Let's talk about the business today. It's a $30 billion or thereabouts, $30 billion market cap business. It's, as I said, the largest software business on the Australian market. Which is an important position because most portfolios around the country probably has some WiseTech now, which wouldn't have been the case only up until a few years ago. But it comes with some interesting elements and challenges being that big. One of them, and I know dear to your heart, is employees. It's a competitive market, tech companies. Relate that. How do you retain people? How do you get good people? How do you educate them? I know education's close to your heart and how it should play out and how it works into industry and work. Do you want to elaborate about how you go about that? Because the people are the lifeblood of your business.
They are. And in fact, they're really the intellectual property of the business. They go home every night. Well, we hope they do anyway.
And you've got to keep attracting them.
Absolutely. So there is a job, it's a marketing and sales job, to continue to communicate how good it is to work at WiseTech. We've got extremely low turnover. Even through those troubling times in 22, when wages were going crazy and there hadn't been a lot of immigration into Australia for a long time and we were locked down. We didn't lose many staff at all. And we continued to hire in a very sensible way. We didn't get ahead of ourselves and start throwing money at problems. And we've provided, all of our technologists have quite a decent part of their package is equity. And that equity has a four-year vest. And we put a lot of effort into making sure that people get educated and they get developed. We have very sophisticated systems. We have an academy, WiseTech Academy. I do speak a lot in public about the value of a long-term employment. There's a lot of startups that have, they come up very quick, they employ a lot of people and then suddenly run out of money and then everybody's gone. WiseTech has never had a layoff like that. We've obviously managed our staff well, but we have been continuing to employ at about the same rate for the last, compared to the size of the company it's growing, but about the same net rate, percentage-wise. We're probably employing somewhere between 25 and 35 people a month in the company at the moment. Now, the acquisitions add a bit to that, so that's a way of increasing your employee count as well. But we have an organic and inorganic growth structure, both for employees and for obviously revenue and so forth. But the job of a company is to attract, to be able to identify good employees, so you know that the people that you're looking for, that you're attracting, are the ones that you want to employ, filtering those down to the ones that are really high quality that are going to want to stay with the company, onboarding them, developing them in the company and helping them be retained. Because, employee has no responsibility to be retained. We have all the responsibility to make the environment where people want to work there and stay there for the long term. Now, the share price and the acquisition of shares in their portfolio does a very good job of that. But equally, our earn and learn program and our commitment to education, our sponsorship of Grok and all the other social programs we do in that education space have an enormous impact on the values that our staff think about the company.
Well, you've gone even further than that in terms of both WiseTech, you've outlined there, and yourself.
Yeah.
Giving money and giving support to Grok, you've talked about, but education in general and science and maths. It's something Australia's not quite getting right.
That's true. Science and maths participation rates have fallen in the last 10 years. And worse than that, our success rate in those people that are participating has been falling. So that's a serious problem. We've been saying the word STEM everywhere, in every place, in government, in education, in high schools, and in every other place. And whilst that's being talked about so much, the actual participation rate's been falling. So that's not a solution. I like to think about root cause analysis and what really is going on. And there's things that we can do to help that. One of the things that we're doing, and it's just one of the many programs that we're doing, is called Earn and Learn. It's very powerful. We start engaging with high school students probably around year 9 or 10, and most of that's through Grok Academy because they've got a learning platform for technology, and that's developing out to be an education platform for a lot of other things, science and maths particularly. And we then offer people full-time employment straight out of high school and a part-time university degree in computer engineering, which means that they have a full-time wage. They start at about $65,000 a year. If they get good academic results, they get their HEX paid for, and they also get a share portfolio which vests starting on their graduation, which means they've probably spent 4 years making a lot more money than any university graduate gets for the first 2 years of their year. Now, these are high-value students. We don't just...
It's very attractive.
It is very attractive, and it's also very sustaining for the company because we're attracting very high-quality candidates. We're getting people that are the technologists of the future straight out of high school, and there's a huge difference in the educational rate of those students. So after 1 year, the first cohort of those Earn and Learn students are performing better than university graduates. Mm. That's in 1 year.
Because it's more practical?
It's because of that fluency, because you're sitting in a job. You've got to deliver code. You're sitting next to professionals who can teach you and who can review your code and look at and teach you things. And there's an academy that you're attending as well as the university. And you're doing it every day so that your code is going to become production code and go to a customer. And it's really important that it works well. So there's a real positive stress on those students to do the right thing and to learn quickly. And that fluency develops much more quickly than you would at university. Now, you need this practical theory, the theory as well as the practical, but that theory needs to be weaved into the practical. At university, it's theory for 3 or 4 years, and then you're in a practical sense. We go practical and theory at the same time.
So that's the quality of the business. How would you describe today, if we move forward to WiseTech today, as mm-hmm. we said, the big company on the ASX in terms of software, the DNA of the company, what would you describe it as today?
So I do think that companies are effectively a product of their culture. And if anybody wants to go to the website and look at the credo, I think you'll see that we have a purpose. We care about the technologies that we use. We care about creating solutions. We actually say at the end, we're changing the world one innovation at a time. And they're all small innovations, but there are thousands of them. And we're doing things across the supply chain in ways that people never thought possible because they didn't think of it that way. You know, Einstein said, a problem cannot be solved with the level of consciousness that created the problem. You have to be far, far more articulate and understanding what's going on so that you can see the deeper part of the problem to solve it. And that's what WiseTech does. It's an intelligent company. It's got a learning culture. It's got a very strong, positive culture.
And that culture, what's the biggest threat to the business? Is it someone else coming along with a better culture and a better ability to solve problems? Is it going away from that core? What disrupts this business that have grown so strongly over the years?
Well, I'm constantly worrying about that particular issue. I call this particular problem entropy, because if you leave something alone, a highly, highly energetic thing, it dissipates. So you've got to constantly be repositioning it, repurposing it, relearning it, reteaching it, and making sure that the culture doesn't diffuse. So this entropy is something that happens in all systems, and you have to act against that. So we spend a lot of time thinking about what the culture is and how that works, and you know, how does a particular type of behavior affect that culture? How much too many meetings becomes a problem? No meetings becomes a problem. So you've got to have a system that is able to run a company with 30 different offices around the world and 3,500 staff. Probably the way to think about this is that you think about it as a systemic way of having a system that has a culture that drives the system. The reason we're doing things is because we like to solve problems. We like to find root causes. We like to solve things to make them better. That's the culture.
And with that culture, can you see a limit to the business? It's been a great growth story, got a lot of support among investors. Is there a limit to it?
When I was five star,
will it run out of steam? Will it become a mature company?
I don't think so. A lot of people talk about base effect, right? And you know, companies, no matter who you are, WiseTech included, there's always ups and downs in a business. But there is so much more to solve that WiseTech has got an enormous capacity to solve and to continue to grow. When I was five staff, people said, oh, this is a great company, but you'll never get to 25 with that style of organization. When I was 25, they'd say, you'll never get to 100. When I was 100, they'd say, I'll never get to 500. We didn't change really at all. We basically kept the same very flat structure, culturally driven. You know, we say culture eats strategy for lunch, because unless you have a culture, you never get to implement strategy. You have to have people that care about things so that they're going to say, this is the strategy, let's go do it. Because strategy is just words on a piece of paper. What you actually need is people that operationally and tactically can build things.
So I'm going to take that as WiseTech's still got a bright future and many years to grow. Bring it back to Richard White. You've been at the core of it, built the business, established the DNA and how it should be done. What happens with you in terms of succession, retirement? What do you see? Do you think about that, or are you just in the business for as long as you can be?
I'm going to be doing this for quite a long time. My role has changed dramatically in many stages, and it will continue to change. I'm much more strategic than I was in the past. I just created a new type of board report which is much more a stream of consciousness, and we're working on these internal things we call work streams, which is a new way of thinking about how you collaborate and communicate. I saw Scott Farquhar the other day was writing about the problem of meetings in companies, and it's a problem, right? They're
inefficient.
They're very inefficient because they drag everybody in. What you really need to do is to have a way of communicating that is scalable, but it doesn't drag everybody into every meeting. And that scaling problem has to continuously be resolved so that the next level of scale doesn't have an effect of slowing the business down. So I'm very conscious of the engineering of the business's structure and how you try to make the business very automated. WiseTech's
the same problem you had in the late 80s.
It is the same problem. It's just that it's being done at a much bigger scale now, and the numbers involved are much bigger. But like I said, I don't think a base effect really affects software companies that are built properly. And if you can look at the industry that we're in, we've solved for one really big piece of the industry, that's international piece, but there's 10 times that we haven't even touched. So whatever we've got now, we've still got a lot of space to move into. And that doesn't even start to address the value creation part of what we do. So we've got...
You're talking about the domestic ones.
Well, I'm talking about landside logistics, domestic. Yep. There's all these other layers to logistics itself. And then you get into supply chain, which is further down and up and down the chain of things that happen. There's 20, 30 years of growth here that we can continue to build.
So the tentacles we talked about in the introduction, they're going to grow further. So one step further, and a nice way to finish up would be... It's been a great journey, as I said, 40-odd years. What's the legacy, the Richard White legacy?
So I don't really think... My view of the legacy is if I could do something really meaningful for education and the company do something meaningful for education and the company continue to be successful post my involvement in the company, it would be a great success. That would be the thing that motivates me. I don't want to write my life story. I have these little chats with people. This is enough. I think, you know, I talk to the staff a lot about this stuff because the history is quite important. But my goal is to make WiseTech an ever greater company that is reliably able to grow from many, many different people with many different ideas in this structured space. And I'd like to do something really meaningful for education, particularly in Australia. But if we do it for Australia, it's probably going to work for the world as well.
Well, it sounds like you're well on your way to doing that, given all the different ventures you're involved in. So I'd like to say thanks for coming in. Great, great life story, terrific business. Everyone's very jealous that we weren't there in those early days with the 5-cent options. But it sounds like it's got a very bright future. So we say thanks for coming in and thanks for telling us your story.
Well, thanks for the questions were fantastic, and it was a really enjoyable thing to talk about. And I'm so glad that I met you.